There is magic in thinking big, but it's so easy to forget. When that I haven't got what it takes feeling creeps up on you, think big. Remember, if you think you are inadequate, you are. Concentrate on your assets. Know your positive self. Think big enough to see how good you really are.
David Schwartz, author and professor at Georgia State University, is a national authority on motivation. He has spoken to thousands at conventions and management seminars over the past 30 years. For the next hour, David Schwartz will be sharing with you a range of techniques for magnifying your thinking power. Thinking big, the idea that you are cut out to be and do the best, is the key to success in anything. Belief in great results is the driving force behind all great plays, scientific discoveries, loving and lasting relationships. It's behind every successful business, church, and political organization. That's because belief, strong belief, actually triggers the mind to find the ways, the means, the how-to to get things done. On this Sound Ideas cassette by Simon & Schuster, you'll discover that the magic of thinking big involves some very down-to-earth techniques. On side one, you'll learn how to spot and cure the small thinker's biggest problem, excuse-itis. You'll find out why the power of belief is so important to thinking big. And David Schwartz will show you how to make your attitudes your allies in developing confidence. On side two, you will be introduced to the big thinker's vocabulary. You will find out how to store valuable ideas so you can turn them into something big. And David Schwartz will help you set goals to get you started on short-term progress toward a long-term investment in yourself. Your personal training program for success will be built on the attitudes and techniques of big thinkers. How do they think? How do they come up with new ideas? You'll learn the key to creative thinking, and you'll find out how to put all of this to use in overcoming life setbacks. This program is guided by a series of concrete examples, and there are exercises for you to try over the next hour. But remember, your training is self-administered. This cassette is a guide. The rest is up to you. Here's David Schwartz.
When it comes to thinking big, you have to make your attitudes your allies. Where success is concerned, people are not measured in inches or pounds or college degrees or family background. People are measured by the size of their thinking. How big do we think determines the size of our accomplishments? Now, all of us want to enlarge our thinking. Let's see how.
Ever ask yourself, what is my biggest weakness? David Schwartz believes the greatest human weakness of all is self-depreciation, selling yourself short. And self-depreciation shows through in countless ways. You see an ad in the newspaper for just the job you'd like to have, but you don't apply. You think, I'm not good enough for that job, so why bother? You've got your eye on a new manager in your office, but you don't even ask for a date because you think you don't rate. You've just come up with a really innovative product, a new kind of software, or a better chocolate chip cookie, but you don't go to the very company that could get it on the market for you because you think that company is too big time for you and your invention. Self-depreciation shows itself in lots of little ways. You ask for a smaller raise than you'd really like, or you brush it off when no one notices that the much-praised reorganization of the office files was your idea. Even in the smallest ways, you can sell yourself short.
Philosophers for thousands of years have issued good advice. Know thyself. But most people, it seems, interpret this suggestion to mean know only thy negative self. Now, it's well to know our inabilities. But if we only know our negative characteristics, we're in a mess. Our value is small. Here's an exercise to help you measure your true size.
This exercise, which has worked in hundreds of executive training sessions, begins with you determining your five chief assets. These assets can be anything about yourself that you know are worth something. A college degree, perhaps, or your reputation for having a way with kids. Or maybe you're one of those people who's always calm under pressure. Or you can make a decision and stick with it. Anything, really, that amounts to one of your good points. Invite someone you know, and whom you respect, to help you with the list. It could be a coworker, or your spouse, or a fellow student or professor. Someone, by the way, who will be honest and give you a straight answer. Now, under each one of your chief assets, write the name of three people who have made it big in your eyes, but who do not have that particular asset.
Complete this exercise, and you'll discover you outrank many successful people on at least one asset. There is only one conclusion you can honestly reach. You're bigger and better than you think. So, fit your thinking to your true size. Never, absolutely never, sell yourself short.
Seems like everyone I work with is much older than I am, and it's really hard for me to get any respect from them. And so, when I set a goal for myself, I have the feeling that I'm never going to accomplish it, because everyone's looking at me and saying, oh, she's such a baby, she can't really do this. And they think I'm too young, it makes me think I'm too young. And maybe I am too young to do it.
Truth is, I've always dreamed about being a stockbroker, something exciting like that, dealing with a lot of money. And I think I have the mind for it, but the only problem is I don't think I have the stomach for it. I mean, my nerves aren't very good anyway, and the least thing upsets my stomach, so I just don't think I'd last in something like that.
I mean, I'd like to go into the music field. I really always liked music, but it's hard. I've been out of school for so many years. I'm old. I'm 31. Everybody in school is 17, 18. And to get into a music school, you have to try out. They have to see whether you're a good enough musician or not. You know, what if I'm no good?
Perhaps the easiest way to differentiate a big thinker from a small thinker is how they deal with the problems of life. All the small people I know consistently suffer from a disease called excuse-itis. They make all kinds of excuses to explain why they can't do something, why something won't work, why we shouldn't even try.
Excusitis comes in many forms, but there are several common and particularly virulent strains of the disease. One of the main ones is intelligence excusitis.
I'm not quite smart enough to handle this situation. I'm not quite smart enough or intelligent enough to call on this prospect. I'm not quite smart enough to apply for this job. I'm not quite smart enough to conduct this meeting. I'm not quite smart enough to make more money. Now, if you're listening to this tape with someone else, do me a favor. Take a good look at that person and think this. That person is only half as smart as you've been conditioned to think. You know, my friends, we make two mistakes about intelligence. One, we grossly overestimate the other person. And second, we grossly underestimate ourselves.
Then there's age excusitis. You've heard it, and you've probably used it at one time or another. People are inclined to think they're either too old or too young, but look at it realistically. Apple Computer was started by two young men barely out of college who capitalized on a good idea and ended up computer superstars. Orson Welles was only 25 when he created the film classic Citizen Kane, and director Susan Scheidelman was about that age when she made the modern hit movie Desperately Seeking Susan. At the other end of the calendar, you have the world's biggest hamburger chain, McDonald's. Its founder was in his 50s when he hatched the idea of this fast food chain. The original Colonel Sanders was drawing his first Social Security check when he went national with his Kentucky Fried Chicken. And Ronald Reagan became president just days before his 70th birthday.
Our chronological age is not what's important. Our attitude toward life is what counts.
Yet a third form of this disease is one that persists in spite of the current rage for health clubs and vitamins. It's called health excusitis. And if you don't believe a lot of people have it, just add up the number of ads and TV commercials you see telling you how to get rid of aches and pains. Now, no one is physically perfect. There's something physically wrong with just about everyone. And because your ailments are not unusual, they are also not very interesting. When you complain about the lower back pain you've developed from sitting at a desk all day, or your shin splints from jogging, or the eye strain the computer terminal gives you, you're simply switching off other people's interest in you and what you have to say. Ask yourself, would you like to be on the receiving end of your physical complaints? Your answer will probably be a resounding no.
Nobody enjoys pain. And when you complain about how bad you feel, you simply become a symbol of pain. As you complain about your pain, you are encouraging other people to leave you.
When you're next tempted to sink into complaining about yourself as a substitute for going out and doing something constructive, remind yourself of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Crippled by polio as a young adult, he went on to become the only president in our nation's history elected to 4 terms in office. Or think of TV star Mary Tyler Moore, who has succeeded at a demanding career despite diabetes. There are plenty of examples closer to home of people overcoming physical problems, big and small. Just watch the evening news. But let's say you take aerobics 3 times a week. You're the picture of fitness, and you're proud of it. Health is not the thing that's holding you back. In your case, it's luck. Everyone else, it seems, has all the good kind.
Some people just have luck. I mean, I work hard. I know I'm doing the job. I know I'm doing better than a lot of people are doing. But for some reason, one particular person that I work with seems to get all the benefits no matter what without even trying.
I have one friend who's really lucky. It just seems like whenever something's going wrong for both of us, the situation turns around and gets better for her before it gets better for me. I remember about 6 months ago, we both broke up with the guy that we were seeing. And, you know, it only took her like another month to meet someone that she was really interested in and who was really interested in her. It just seems like she gets everything when she wants it, the way she wants it. I mean, it has to be luck. There's no other explanation.
I just never accomplish anything. I'm so busy trying to undo the bad luck that always finds me that I'm running around in circles all day. And by the time I get done with the day, I'm trying to do what I started out doing after I unraveled all the bad things that happened to me. So I'm nowhere.
Luck, you say. But is it really? Or do you have a severe case of luck excusitis? Look closely, and you'll find that the person who is winning the promotions, making friends and cultivating romance, or being sought out for creative ideas, is not succeeding by chance.
Luck has very, very little to do with anything. The people who are successful are those who are working the hardest and doing all they can to make their dreams come true.
Curing excusitis is surprisingly simple. The hard part is recognizing that you have it, that you are using excuse after excuse to get out of trying to get what you really want out of life. Recognize yourself in any of these forms of excusitis? Then do this. Tell yourself over and over again, my attitude is more important than my IQ. And no one is ever too old or too young. Refuse to worry about your health. And more important, refuse to talk about it. And remember, there's no such thing as bad luck, only lost opportunities. You know, your mind is nothing but a thought factory, and a busy one, manufacturing countless thoughts, good and bad, every day. An amusing but very helpful way to look at your thought factory is to imagine it under the charge of 2 very different foremen. David Schwartz has dubbed them Mr. Triumph and Mr. Defeat.
Mr. Triumph is in charge of manufacturing positive thoughts, and he specializes in producing reasons why you can, why you are qualified, why you will win. The other foreman, Mr. Defeat, produces negative, depreciating thoughts. He's your expert in developing reasons why you can't, why you're weak, why you're inadequate. His specialty is the why you will fail kind of thinking. To see how these foremen work for you, try this example. Tell yourself, today is a lousy day. This signals Mr. Defeat into action, and he manufactures some facts to prove why you are right. He suggests to you that it's too hot or too cold, or business will be lousy, other people will be on edge, you may get sick, your wife or husband will be in a fussy mood. Mr. Defeat is a tremendously efficient servant. In just a few minutes, he's got you sold. It is a bad day. Before you know it, it is a heck of a bad day. But tell yourself today's a fine day, and Mr. Triumph goes to work. He tells you, look, it's a wonderful day. The weather is refreshing. It's good to be alive. Today you can catch up on some of your work, and then it is a good day. The more work you give to either of these two foremen, the stronger he becomes. The only wise thing to do is simply fire Mr. Defeat. Mr. Defeat won't help you get you where you want to go, so kick him out. When any thought enters your mind, ask Mr. Triumph to go to work for you. He'll show you how you can succeed.
Every day there is opportunity, a chance to put Mr. Triumph to work. And the desire to turn opportunity into reward is one of the reasons you're listening to this cassette, instead of waiting for the lucky break that may never come. The door to success is wide open, but the first step through it is believing in yourself. Belief can move mountains.
You can't wish away a mountain. You can't wish yourself into an executive suite. Nor can you wish yourself into a fine home. But you can win success by believing you can succeed. There is nothing magical or mystical about the power of belief. Belief, the positive I can attitude, generates the power, the skill, and the energy needed to do it. Doubt, the subconscious will to fail, the not really wanting to succeed, is responsible for most failures. Belief in success is the one basic, absolutely essential ingredient in all successful people. Believe, really believe, you can succeed and you will.
Ah, but you say, believing is one thing, doing is another.
The fact is, I've never gone in there. I can't ask for that raise. Every time I think about going into that office, every time I think about it, there's like this incredible sort of mass of marshmallows that stops me. It's like this incredible wall that does not let me just walk on. And there's nothing that I can do to get rid of it.
There's this woman at work who I'd love to call up, but I'm really afraid of not succeeding, and the fear of the rejection is great. The fear of making a fool of myself is great. All this ties my stomach up in knots. So rather than call her up and risk embarrassment at work or risk her saying no and not having any chance, I just won't call her up.
The fact is, many people are paralyzed by fear, and fear is very, very real.
Now, our friends mean well when they tell us, look, it's only your imagination. Don't worry. There's nothing to be afraid of. But there is. You and I know that this kind of fear medicine never works, because fear is real. Fear is success enemy number one. Fear stops people from capitalizing on opportunity. Fear closes your mouth when you want to speak. Fear actually makes people sick. Fear is a powerful force. In one way or another, fear prevents people from getting what they want. Now, the first treatment for fear is to condition yourself to one simple fact. All confidence is acquired or developed. No one is born with confidence. The people you know who radiate confidence have acquired their confidence, every bit of it.
Acquiring confidence is not as hard as you think. Banishing fear and developing confidence actually involves only one thing, getting the action habit. You must simply plunge in and do the thing you fear the most every time.
Action cures fear. Do the thing you fear, and fear will disappear. Afraid to speak up in a classroom? Speak up. Afraid to ask for promotion? Ask for it. You see, one of the truly great success proverbs is simply this. Ask, it shall be given unto you. Knock, and it shall open. Action is what cures fear. The longer we meditate about fear, the longer we postpone doing something we are afraid to do, the more difficult, the more impossible it seems. So do this. Right now, think of one thing you dread most doing, and then do it.
Let's think about some things that you might do to get the action habit in the face of a few common fears. Try them. For example, it's natural to fear getting a bad evaluation when you're new on a job and still being watched. So instead of worrying, do this. Tackle the project or job that is your weak spot. Stay with it until you've mastered it. And even the attempt at doing better will build your confidence. How about the fear of what other people think? There's no one who doesn't worry about looking bad. So do this. Put people in perspective. Remind yourself that other people are not as smart as you might think they are, and you are smarter than you think. Then tell yourself this. No one ever does anything worthwhile for which they're not criticized. Expect to be sniped at by small thinkers, but take it as proof that you are growing. And then go ahead and act. Then there's that fear that sometimes creeps up on us. It's a sense that something is going to go wrong, but you don't know what it is. Now, a good way to counter this vague fear is by putting your mind to work thinking about something you can control. It's a good idea to keep it simple. Sitting down to write the great American novel, or delving inward to come up with the invention that's going to make you rich, will probably only add to your sense of impending doom. Rather than take on a large challenge, start with something basic, close to home. Try tackling that repair job you've been putting off for weeks because it takes too much figuring out. You'll be surprised how fast vague fears disappear when you're concentrating on taking accurate measurements or trying to figure out just how to jiggle that screw in. And doing something for someone else is a sure fear cure. Is your neighborhood school having a fundraiser to buy some new sports equipment? Pitch in, help with the publicity, or organize the raffle. Again, these are all examples of how you can act in the face of fear. But you are unique, so be creative. Tailor your own way of acting to who you are. And make no mistake about it, action does cure fear. Once fear is banished, how do we move on to build confidence? David Schwartz has a simple but very successful 5-step method for increasing your confidence quotient.
First, be a front seater. Have you ever noticed in meetings, in church, in classrooms, in business conferences, in any kind of assembly, how quick the back seats fill up? Most folks scramble to sit in the back rows so they won't look too conspicuous.
And the reason they're afraid to be conspicuous is that they lack confidence. It's as simple as that. Sitting in the back makes you feel smaller, almost invisible. But think about it. Do you really want to feel small? Remember, a first step to thinking big is feeling big. So make it a habit, whenever you enter a room full of people, head straight for the front row. Find the spot where you can see and be seen, and make it your own. When you sit up front, you also build your confidence. Just practice it and see. Now for confidence builder number 2.
Practice making eye contact. Remember, the eyes, in fact, are the mirrors of your soul. How a person uses his eyes tells us a lot about him. Looking the other person in the eye tells that person, I am honest and above board. I believe in what I'm telling you, I'm not afraid, and I'm confident. Eye contact not only gives you confidence, it wins you confidence too. Point 3. Walk 25% faster. Psychologists link slovenly postures and sluggish walking to unpleasant attitudes towards oneself. But psychologists also tell us you can actually change your attitudes by changing posture and speed of movement.
Just watch people walk past any busy corner, and you'll discover that body action is always the result of mind action. The down-and-out person telegraphs that to the world by shuffling along as if there is nowhere to go. The average person has just an average walk, not too fast, not too slow, just trying to get from here to there. But there's a third group, a few individuals who really stand out.
People in this group show super confidence. They walk faster than the average folks. There seems to be a slight sprint in the way they walk. Their walk tells the world, I've got someplace important to go, and by golly, I've got something important to do.
So do this. Next time you head down the street, even if you're just going to the store for a loaf of bread, walk faster. Hold your head up high. Keep a brisk pace to your stride, and you'll find you feel better about yourself. Walk faster, and you can't help but feel that you are heading for something bigger and better.
Point 4. Practice speaking up. In working with many kinds of groups, I've watched people with keen perception and much native ability freeze and fail to participate in discussions. It isn't that these people don't want to get in and wade with the rest of us. Rather, it's simply lack of confidence. Each time the conference clam fails to speak, he feels even more inadequate, more inferior. Often he makes a faint promise to himself that down deep inside he knows he's not going to keep, to speak out next time. This is very important. Each time our clam fails to speak, he takes one more dose of confidence poison. The only people who get ahead in this world are people who talk.
So don't be a conference clam. Even when you're nervous or feeling a little down, speak up. Speak up at every opportunity and your confidence will soar. Now for that final step in building your CQ, confidence quotient. It's simple to put into practice, something you can do many times every single day. And that's smile big.
Try this little test. Try for a moment to feel defeated and then smile big at the same time. You can't. A big smile gives you confidence. A big smile beats fear, rolls away worry, and defeats despondency.
So smile. And while you're at it, remember to do these other confidence builders. Be a front seater. Sit where you can see and be seen. Make eye contact, always. Walk faster. See if you can speed up by at least 25%. And speak up. If you think it, say it. Even if they don't always agree, people will respect you for having your own ideas. Now let's see how you can manage your memory so as to build confidence. David Schwartz suggests you should think of your brain as a bank, and every day you make thought deposits in this mind bank, deposits that grow and become your memory. When you settle down to think, or when you're tackling a problem, in effect, you begin to make withdrawals from your memory bank.
Your memory, then, is a basic supplier of raw material for every new thought. Your memory doesn't care what you put into it, but it's infallible. Your memory will recall what you ask it to recall. If you approach the teller and say, "Mr. Teller, let me withdraw some thoughts I deposited in the past, proving I'm inferior to just about everybody else," your teller will say, "Certainly, sir. Recall what your sixth grade teacher told you about your inability to accomplish things, and recall what you overheard some fellow worker say about you." On and on Mr. Teller goes, digging out of your brain thought after thought that proves you are indeed inadequate. But suppose you visit your memory teller with this request. "Mr. Teller, I face a tough decision. Can you supply me with any thoughts which you believe will give me some reassurance?" And again, the teller will say, "Well, certainly, sir." But this time he delivers thoughts that say you can succeed. "Recall the excellent job you did in a similar situation before," or "Recall how much confidence Mr. Smith placed in you." "Recall what your good friend said about you." Mr. Teller, perfectly responsive, lets you withdraw the thought deposits you want to withdraw. After all, it is your bank.
And because it is your bank, you can do something about how it is managed. Now, unpleasant things happen to all of us. And while you can't control what goes into your memory bank, you can decide what to take out. The difference between successful and unsuccessful people is that unsuccessful people overdraw on their negative account. They go to bed worrying about the negative remark, the foul-up at work, the way they were late for an important appointment. Worse, when they wake up, these negative memories are the first thing on their minds. Successful people, those ready to go to work on their big ideas, never give another thought to the petty, bad things that happened that day. They simply resolve to do better, and they move on.
Again, I repeat, withdraw only positive thoughts from your memory bank.
You've learned that excusitis is a sure way to keep your thinking small. You have now decided to fire Mr. Defeat and keep Mr. Triumph working overtime. You know how to make your attitudes your allies. It is natural to fear doing any number of things, and most people fear something. But you now have a way to conquer fear by taking action, and you know new ways to develop confidence. It's time to turn the cassette over and discover still more tips and techniques for thinking big.